Welcome back, friends. Thanks for joining us today as we continue to move through Genesis, and particularly as we move into the Noah story, probably getting done with the sixth chapter today. We have been at the point where God has made his intention clear, that being upset with the state of the creation, he is going to destroy it. And he's going to make one exception, Noah, which will turn into several exceptions, including Noah's family and animals. We're not yet there. As we move into this section today, God is explaining to Noah what he wants him to do. So he's really kind of presenting this path to rescue and what it looks like for Noah. And it's not an easy path. There is a great deal involved. We have this section which gives some kind of details which both add credence to the story and complicate our reaction to the story. We'll talk about that in a minute. I'm not going to read this word for word, but we will jump in here at verse 13 of chapter 6. So God said to Noah, "I'm going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence, and because of them, I am surely going to destroy both them and the earth. So make yourself an ark of cypress wood. Make rooms in it. Coat it with pitch inside and out. This is how you should build it." And then he proceeds to give dimensions. Verse 17, "I'm going to bring floodwaters on the earth to destroy all life under the heavens. Every creature that has the breath of life in it, everything on earth will perish. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you will enter the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. You are to bring into the ark two of all living creatures, male and a female. Keep them alive with you, two of every kind of bird, of every kind of animal, and every kind of creature that moves along the ground will come to you to be kept alive. You are to take every kind of food that is eaten and store it away as food for you and for them." And then Noah did everything just as God commanded him. So this is the kind of nuts and bolts story of the ark, and this is probably the classic version that people know. God comes to Noah. We like to read into this story the sort of incredible nature of it, and is Noah stunned by it? How does he react? Those are not questions the scripture is very interested in. Generally, when it comes to faithfulness, the Bible is binary. You either do or don't. There are a couple of exceptions. Abraham does some haggling with God. Moses goes back and forth. But in general, the Bible is far more interested in what happens when a person does what God tells them to do. And so here, Noah gets this massive undertaking that he's called to do, not only to build an ark, but to collect all of the foods and all of the animals that are present on the earth. And if you were with us in the early part of this study, particularly chapter one, you know this language: every bird, every creature that crawls. This in some way is mere language of the creation story. And that's not an accident, Michael.
No, right. It's not an accident. It is really connecting to the point that you made, I believe it was yesterday, Clint, that it's strange, really, when you think of it, that the human sinfulness that has beset the world also has an impact on the creatures, on the very animals that crawl on the ground, that these animals are going to suffer the judgment as well, that the flood will come up and kill them. And so what we discover is that God has made not only a way for Noah, who we learned is a righteous man, and so this is how he was chosen, but he must now steward these animals that God is also going to save from the judgment, which is being meted out due to human violence and human sinfulness. And so we see that original creation story mirrored here. What's happening is that the very creature, you know, in this case, Noah, who we saw mirrored in that first creation story, Adam, who's tasked with this stewarding task, name these animals, care for them. Here, Noah, the creature, once again, is now caring for the rest of this creation, serving as that sort of under shepherd. And so we do, Clint, we're seeing another kind of recreation, except in this case, it's a reset as opposed to a make everything new. That we're now going to go back to the way that things were. And water's going to provide that sort of ultimate reset button. And it's interesting because God has intended to save both humanity and creatures as part of this.
And what was true in the first story implicitly is now explicit, in that in the creation, there was this kind of implied covenant. There was this working arrangement between God and Adam and Eve. They had roles, they had relationship. But here, for the first time, the word covenant is used. That word in Hebrew is the same in Greek. It means testament. It means literally, probably in its simplest translation, promise. And God says in verse 18, I will establish my promise. In other words, I will build. I will make my promise with you. And this begins the idea that there is a lineage to God's action. There is a line that God has committed to, covenanted to. And Noah will be the first of that. And that God, as God does this reset, will be particularly invested in Noah and his people, or at least one could say down the road in a particular people. And that's really, it's common language for everything on the other side of Genesis 6, but it's new language at this point of the story.
Yeah. And that is interesting, Clint, because the covenantal part of Noah's story is substantial. It is the beginning of God making these commitments. First of all, making this covenant that is ultimately going to protect the world from this same kind of cataclysmic disaster, a very kind of universal covenant. As Genesis goes on, that covenant's going to be much more specific. That covenant's going to happen with Abraham. And it's going to be named for his particular heirs and for the generations that will follow him. And then, you know, the author of Genesis is going to tease out how God remains committed and faithful in relationship. This is an amazing turn here in Genesis chapter 6. The interesting thing is, especially to modern sensibility, I think our imaginations are far more captured by the questions of, like, what did the ark look like? How did you fit that many animals in the ark? How much food would you need to feed that many animals? We have such a very under the hood kind of imagination, and we bring very kind of practical questions to the text. What's interesting is, though, while we do get some dimensions of the ark here, far more of what this text is about is about God making this promise and then ultimately God seeing to this promise as we go. So we see the implications of Noah in many chapters beyond just Noah's story. And yet oftentimes, you know, we sort of get fixated on, well, what did it look like and how did it happen? And it's not that those questions are wrong, Clint, but they are a little bit red herrings. They lead us away from the center of the text. And as we sort of engage them, we miss some of the questions that the original authors might have asked us to consider, I think.
I want to be very careful with this, and so please listen to this carefully. There is no doubt that the people who received this story, by and large, received it as a literal story. That is, they believed in the details of the story as facts. But when we try to take the story apart literally, in other words, when we get drawn into how could you gather animals from cold places and warm places? How could you get all of the fruits and all of the things that aren't even in season? What about the things that don't even grow in that part of the world? How could you get animals? When we get bogged down in the literal questions, I think that ironically, it leads us further from the text. In other words, even though the hearers took this as literal, they didn't take it as something that had to be defended and explained. They simply received it as truth. And if we can read it that way, if we can simply read it as true without having to think, well, how did he do this? And what could he do? And how would that have worked? When we get bogged down in that, it seems to me that we run the risk of missing some of the spiritual truth of the story and replacing it with a kind of practical approach that I don't think this story really was ever meant to convey. This is a God story. This is not an ark story. This is not an animal story. This is not a storage or a flotation story. This is a God story. And when we get our focus on those other things, we sometimes are inclined to minimize that.
Yeah, it's interesting how easy it is for us to fixate on the two of every kind and take with you all the food that is eaten, store it up. We might get fixated on, well, how many cubic feet does it take to store that kind of food for that many days? And we completely miss that what's at stake is, will Noah follow God's directions? What matters is, whose direction setting is Noah going to follow? Is he going to say yes to God? And therefore, is he going to do it God's way? Or is he going to pursue his own means? And what is striking about Noah's story is its connections literarily. So the word ark that's translated here, ark, is going to appear again. It's going to appear in Moses's telling way into the next book in Exodus. Moses is going to be put into an ark, and that's the thing that's going to save him. Of course, we know it as a basket of reeds, but the words translated are equal. So God is choosing this instrument. He's choosing to tell Noah, this is the way that you'll be saved. And Noah has the choice to follow God. And in the same way, God is going to save Moses so that Moses can be this leader who will take the people out of Egypt. Another story of God's faithfulness and protection. So just even in the vocabulary, we have the connections here to the central figure. And the central figure is God. It's God who's faithful to Noah and to Noah's family, which is another interesting detail of this story, that God doesn't just save one person. He saves those who are connected to him. And then God will choose to work in future times to the same end, to make and keep the same promise that we see God being willing to keep in this case.
I think that I would even go so far as to say, Michael, that the story simply assumes that God's instructions will be enough. The story feels no compulsion to explain any of this, because if God has given the direction can be trusted. The instructions are completely reliable because of the source they come from. And I want to sort of highlight something that you alluded to yesterday. One of the things, and again, if we get bogged down in that stuff, if we chase those rabbit trails too far, we miss the hammer of this story. The end of verse 17, everything on earth will perish. The idea that creation is at risk and God's mercy is such that God protects a family and a portion of the creation from the destruction that is about to fall upon it, in order that there can be a continuation, in order that there can be life. Notice the idea, because Noah is going to be saved, then the creation should also be saved. There hadn't been language about saving animals, saving birds. That comes in after the promise is made to Noah, that there will be a kind of refilling, a return to be fruitful and multiply. We'll see that literally. And I think, you know, we shouldn't miss that. The other questions are interesting. You know, by all means, have those conversations and, you know, visit the museums and do the things. But we have fought about those things so much that in some ways they've become the point, and they were not intended to be the point.
Yeah, that is actually, I think, one of the larger, to pull back from the Noah conversation. Maybe I should explain why I'm doing that. I think Noah is a particularly difficult section to study because of how ingrained of Noah's story is into our memories. A lot of this comes from felt boards and children's Bibles and pictures. We get this idea of the Noah story, and it's so narrative. It has such a clear character, has such a clear crisis, right? Water coming up and building this thing that saves you. It has a very kind of apocalyptic feel to it. And so it grabs our attention. It holds our imagination. The danger of that is when we frame it into that kind of story, we become tempted then to always return to it as if that unto itself inherently holds the meaning. But, you know, look at imagine the ark and imagine how big it was and how incredible of a thing this is. It grabs our imagination. What it fails to do, though, is help us to begin to see the lesson. The lesson is at what great cost sin has cost humanity, right? That reaching in the garden, that knowing good and evil, what is the outcome of that? We now see it in full display, that the only way to prune the plant is going to be for the plant to grow is going to be to prune it. It's going to be for it to be cut back. Judgment must be brought so that there's a positive and constructive way for humanity to grow and flourish. Such is the state of violence, such is the state of human sinfulness across society, that there must be something done, and that God is going to take this drastic action. We had all the way back, I think it was on Tuesday of this week, this deep and difficult language, God being grieved to the heart. It's clear that this judgment isn't being brought by a joyous, lightning-throwing kind of God. This isn't Zeus, right? This is a God who made and cares and sees this is the only way forward. So my point I'm trying to make is, don't be captivated by the two-by-two conversation and miss the really dark subject matter here, that the cost of sin is unbelievably high and that God is working by God's promise and by God's providence to further humanity and to make creation, in a sense, new again. But this has all come about because of the thing that humans have chosen to do. And so the Noah story is far more about God making an accommodation for us than it is about the details that we often get fixated on. And so we learn something from the story if we can let go of some of those presuppositions that we might not learn if we hold on to them.
Right. And let's try to end on maybe something a little bit more positive. So the last verse here, Noah did everything just as God commanded, which is a kind of refrain we'll see in this story. But we are close enough to chapter 3 of Genesis that we still hear the echoes of Adam and Eve did not, and all of the people did not. And this wickedness on the earth gives evidence that the people did not. And yet Noah met with this extraordinary news and this extraordinarily difficult task, does everything, not only does everything just as God commanded him, to the measurement, to the cubit, to the ingredient, to the seed, the species, the kind. That this is complete obedience from Noah, and this is really the first we've seen of that in the story, and it stands out in contrast to the wickedness of people whose hearts are full of evil all the time.
That's really well said, Clint. In fact, in some ways, in Genesis, it becomes a template of those who will make similar choices. We're going to meet people like Abram, who God comes to and gives a command, and Abram chooses to follow. We learn that these characters have very complicated motives. They don't always get it right, but they are willing. They're open to be obedient. And God not only knows that, but God rewards that. And for all of the time and press we get in the Old Testament for God bringing judgment of all different kinds, God is also faithful and loving and kind and compassionate. And yeah, we see that lived out here in even Noah's story, that God chooses not only Noah, but his family. And he says, to your whole unit, I will show mercy. And I will use you because of your obedience and faithfulness to carry this on. So thanks be to God for those symbols and those people.
Template is a good word, because God... God remembers Noah, and Noah obeys God. So this is there is a paradigm here that we'll see again. We'll see it repeated.
Well,
thanks, Prince, for being with us, everybody.
Yeah, Lord willing, we'll be with you in the studio on Monday. Hope you have a good weekend.
Take care, everyone. Thanks.